Hey, what's going on? Is this Andy?
Yeah.
Oh, going well.
Good, good. I see you got the D.C. area code.
I do, yeah. I've lived in the city a little bit. I've mainly been in Northern Virginia, but I've been in Southern Maryland a little bit and also D.C. A couple times for a couple months here and there.
Where were you born and raised?
Born at Fairfax Hospital, which is like right around the corner, probably 2 miles or so from where I live right now in Falls Church. Raised in Reston, Virginia.
Me too, man. Born in Fairfax,
yeah, man.
Raised in Reston also.
Oh, cool.
Where in Reston did you grow up?
The north side, the Lake Ann side, off of Ring Road at a street called Saffold Way. Otherwise known as Hillcrest Cluster. It was a lot of townhomes in a bunch of different cul-de-sacs. And I lived at the top of the hill in a cul-de-sac with a lot of other kids, like, right around my age, mostly a couple years older.
What was that like in your neighborhood, just, like, growing up?
The neighborhood was awesome. It was great. It was really good for me because I didn't have my dad around and my mom was sick with lupus. And we were in this little cul-de-sac with all these other families with kids like right around our age. And that was back before people locked their doors during the day and sometimes even at night. And kind of created that takes a village atmosphere. Really... I had a lot of people, me and my brother had a lot of other kind of parent figures around, which was really helpful to our upbringing. And it was really fun too. It was like, it was Latchkey Kid era, you know? So it was like, and people weren't wearing pads and helmets. So it was like kind of no holds barred, just playtime all the time. It was great.
And what were you into when you were a little kid? Were you a sports guy? Were you
No, I wasn't into sports. I was into music, but I wasn't playing it. My mom tried to get me into sports. She had me in bowling league, if you even call that a sport. I didn't like that. I was terrible at it. I was in soccer. My brother was in soccer, and he was really good. I didn't really take after him in that way. I eventually ended up being pretty good at sports, but just neighborhood stuff, and I never got into the organized sports thing. But I was into music and books.
What were your favorite books growing up?
I used to read this series called The Three Investigators, which is like the Hardy Boys for kids, like a little bit, a couple years later than the Hardy Boys. It's just like these little mysteries that these kids like had a secret base in a salvage yard, and they would go into this trailer and launch these investigations and solve the crimes. It was like kind of like a Scooby-Doo type scenario.
did you try?
Yeah, those were the first books I got into, and then it kind of branched off into like sci-fi and fantasy and all that. Classic, like, preteen stuff a couple years later. Oh, what's that? I'm sorry?
I was going to ask you if you tried your hand at writing, too.
Well, I did kind of, in a way, because I have an English degree, but that's a very different type of writing, but I kind of find that satisfying. Like, I did my concentration was in cultural studies, which is... kind of gives you analytical tools to step outside of your culture and to analyze things that otherwise might be so normalized that you don't even notice. And I thought that kind of mixed in really well with certain aspects of what I learned from punk rock, which kind of does the same thing. Writing, I've always wanted to write. I have plans, designs to maybe write a book sometime. But that's just, you know, it's a dream right now. Right now I do a lot of writing on the internet, yelling at people on Facebook, like we all do.
So let me ask
I think we're actually all becoming better writers because of Facebook. Like, I think people are learning how to string together better sentences and things like that. I mean, I have no evidence to prove this, but I would suspect.
As an English teacher, I might have to disagree with you on that. I find myself constantly...
Well, I'm not talking about correct English. I'm just talking about putting thoughts together with words on paper on a screen. You can disagree. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. This podcast interview was over.
Well. So something more that occurred to me, since you're sort of an expert on this, having a degree in it, what would you say was the culture of punk rock as you kind of discovered it and engaged with it?
Well, in the 80s, the Breakfast Club in kind of social strata. I mean, it was a metaphor, and it was overly simplified, but it was kind of correct in how strict things were. You were either a jock, or you were a redneck, or you were a preppy, or you were a nerd. And I just kind of didn't feel like that was enough. Felt that that was really limited, and I remember feeling a lot of angst at having to kind of go in a certain direction. I had friends from all over the spectrum that were in my little crew, so I could have headed in any of those directions, but it was just not enough. And then we started listening to some punk and we went to Daryl's video one night, me and some friends, and we checked out a video called DOA, A Rite of Passage, which is like press falling around the Sex Pistols on their tour through America, and it had the Clash in it. So we were a big Clash fan, so we checked this movie out, went home and watched it, and saw that there were other ways of doing things that were all about kind of shattering that social strata, and that was just very exciting to us in the next day, we were shoving safety pins through our ears and wearing our most ratty clothes and markering up our nice button-down shirts and cutting sleeves off and just being kind of creative with the whole thing and, like, taking our nicest clothes and making them our rattiest, coolest clothes and doing things that were upending the whole Breakfast Club kind of strata. And, you know, it was just kind of good fun for a while, but it stuck. It seemed to make sense, so I kind of stuck with it. I'm still with it.
Was it your brother that introduced you to the Clash?
No. He was into heavy metal for a while, and then he went off to boarding school for a year, and he came back as a deadhead. So he was into hippie stuff, and I got into punk because a friend of mine, first there was a friend who lived a couple doors down who I grew up with, his name is Galen, he got into like Billy Idol, I think, and he was like, hey, check this stuff out, there are music videos, and we saw the sneering and the wristband with the studded leather wristband and spiked hair, and I remember we were imitating that, and I went down to Lake Ann one day, and I was playing video games with spiked hair. And we didn't even really know what punk was. What's that?
At Sweet Tooth?
At Sweet Tooth, that's correct. Dave Newman's dad's arcade. I don't remember what I was playing, but there was these guys, a couple years older than us, some of them were actually really like into punk, and they were into punk already. So in comes this kid with spiked hair who they might have known around because my older brother was friends with some of these guys. But some of these guys were already kind of aggressive. So one of them pulls me aside. He's like, you think you're punk? You know, explain to me why you're doing this. And I was petrified because I was like 11, 12 years old or something. And there's this big skinhead like staring me down. And another dude from that scene, the older guys came over and he was like, he used to be my brother's best friend. He kind of pulled this guy back. He was like, hey man, young. He's getting into this. He's one of the first people doing this outside of our generation. So I was a couple years younger than you guys. So lay off. And that was the kind of treatment that you would get for looking at all outside of what you're supposed to look in the Breakfast Club, kind of the strata of that. So anyway, I didn't really know what I was doing, but having this guy do that, I was both kind of little not stoked on this dude for a while, but also I realized how important this culture was to this guy. Like, he didn't want to come in and see someone being a fake, someone that didn't know about it doing it. And that made me think, you know, get real curious about it. And later, probably just after that, another friend of mine, this guy Denton, who lived down the street, he was my age, he gave me The Clash, the first album on tape. He was like, you should listen. I was listening to, like, Rat, Wasp, Iron Maiden, stuff like that. He's like, check this out. It's got the, this might be an exact quote. He's like, this has the energy of Rat, but it's not dumb. And I'm like, okay, I'll check it out. And I was kind of like, bullshit, because I had the Rock the Casbah single, and that's a fucking dance tune. So I was like, this is bullshit. I figured I would be listening to some dance music, right? But I turned it on, the first riff of Clash City Rockers hits, and I was immediately kind of floored by it. These little steps kind of pulled us closer to punk. Like, we were into BMXing, so we were wearing Vans. And then we would go buy our Vans. We would see skateboard stuff around at the Fairfax Surf Shop. Denton's older brother was into skating, so he got into skating. And we were already wearing the clothes, so we switched to skating. Oh, what do skaters listen to? Let's check out some of this music. Agent Orange, some punk rock stuff, you know. We got into the Repo Man soundtrack. Like I said, then eventually we saw that movie DOA, and that was it. That's when we went all in. That was probably like 85.
When did you start to play?
Started playing in ninth grade. It was Boots that did it. This is strange. It sounds strange anyway. But we were all wearing Vans and skating. When we got into punk, we switched to Boots. And my skateboard, like, I was only making like $10 a week in, five or $10 a week in allowance. I didn't have a job. I was in ninth grade. My skateboard broke. I cracked a truck. I still have that truck sitting around, somewhere as memorabilia. And I didn't have money to buy a new one. And I started wearing Boots anyway. And I was like, well, can't really skate good in Boots. What should I do? My brother had a bass lying around. I got grounded. And I was the type of kid, I would do what I was told to do, but I would find the loopholes inside and kind of do what I wanted to do within those constraints. So grounded, and I wasn't going to be doing my homework, especially not while I was grounded. So I just picked up my brother's bass and threw on a Ramones record and figured out Blitzkrieg Bop in like 5 minutes. And I was like, if I can do that, and this song is this good, then I can play. And I mean, it took a long time to be able to really play, but that was, I mean, if I picked up like a Yes record or King Crimson and tried to play along with that day, I probably wouldn't be playing music today. Or I might not be playing music today because that stuff's impossible to do. But the Ramones stuff sounds cool. It's got awesome hooks, a memorable song. I figured it out in 5 minutes with like, almost no time on a fretboard. Like, I'd messed around with a guitar before and tried to take lessons before, but it was a group lesson with me and my friend Farshad, and all we ended up doing was kind of torturing the instructor, harassing him and making fun of him. We were obnoxious kids. Anyway, it was kind of meandering.
Did you find anybody else pretty soon after to jam with when you were in ninth grade?
Yeah, it was, if I have a timeline right, there was a friend of mine who was in my geography class. His name was Eric Weathersby. He was friends with a guy named Chris Pools and another guy named Billy Burna. He met me in geography class, and he was all into like crossover punk, like Corrosion of Conformity, and he was big into like Slayer and bands that were crossing over towards hardcore from metal, Celtic Frost, Slayer, and a bunch of hardcore bands too. And he saw that we were into punk, and he introduced me and my friend Benton to Billy Verna and Chris Pools. And Chris had a guitar, like a little tiny practice amp, and I had a bass. And I didn't have an amp though. And Billy, I think, had a drum kit, and that left Denton with no equipment, so obviously he's a spinner. And so we went to, we skipped school one day, I think, and set up at my house. And we realized Billy didn't have any cymbals or any hi-hat cymbals, so he, we got a circular saw blade from my workroom, and he used that as a cymbal. But once we got that set up, we realized he didn't know anything about drums. Nothing, but none of us did. So all we did that day was play Nuclear Assault, My America, like 50,000 times. Because that's all we knew how to do. And I think the drums weren't even played like drums. I don't really remember. But that didn't last for obvious reasons. And so my friend Farshad, who had been kind of playing like I tried to take lessons with before, kind of started picking up his guitar again. He had moved out to Broad Run. They moved out of Reston. He lived right down the street next to Denton. They grew up together. But he moved out to Broad Run, and he's still trying to hang out. He was like a year older than us, so I think he already had a driver's license, or it didn't take him long before he had his driver's license. He found a dude out there named Pete Kowal, who was really fun and cool, and he kind of introduced him to some punk, and he brought him back to Reston. And so me and Denton and Farshad and Pete Kowal formed a band called the Kids in Dispute. And the first time we practiced, we didn't even know that we were supposed to tune up together. I don't even remember how the other band did My America, because we didn't even know how to tune. But there was a horrendous racket coming from our house, from Denton's house, where we practiced. And one of his friends, his older brother's friends, heard it, and he came over and he taught us how to tune. And that was how Kids in Dispute started, by being taught how to tune. That shows how much attention Farshad and I paid in guitar class. Someone else had to come and show us how. Anyway, that band was really fun and was more about hanging out than anything else. But we tried to play, but none of us had any chops. It was terrible. we did a version of Louie Louie. That was probably the best thing we did because that's like the easiest song to play in the world. And I really don't remember what else we did. We had a practice. There was a practice tape. I don't remember who had it. I remember listening to it. But it's been so long. I don't think I have it because I've kind of gone through all my tapes recently. And if I don't have it, then it might be gone because I kind of ended up as a caretaker for a lot of the old wrestling bands I was in, tracks, recorded stuff. So anyway, that was that terrible band.
What came
terribly,
after that?
Terribly fun, though. It was amazing. What came after that? FSA. What happened with that was Chris Pools, who we'd played with before in the Circular Sawblade band, he'd been playing more. Denton had been singing in Kids of Dispute, so he'd been singing more. I'd been playing bass in Kids of Dispute. So we were like, hey, let's form a band. We need a drummer. And we knew this kid, Todd Riley, who was like a year older than me and Denton, so Chris Pool's age. This is all in Herndon High School, by the way. We grew up in Reston, but back then the north side of Reston went to high school at Herndon High School, and the south side went to South Lakes High School. But all of us had gone to Nice and Hughes Intermediate, which was a tremendous experience. I can't remember where I was there. We found this guy who was a Herndonite proper, Todd Riley. And we heard he was a drummer, so they're like, hey, man, let's jam. So he came over and jammed with us, and he was into punk. I remember he was really into Government Issue and some of the more, like, in some new wave stuff. And he could play. He could play better than me or Denton. And Chris, I think, was the best musician in the band, but we were all so behind him that the band, I think we wrote a couple okay tunes, but we couldn't really play them very well. But there's a couple tracks on the practice tape where something came through, and it was enough to keep us interested in playing. Tried to beef up the sound of FSA in 88. We were around 87, 88 by adding another guitar player, and that just didn't work. And I think Chris wanted to go in a more metal direction. Todd didn't want to play hardcore. He wanted to play punk, but not hardcore. And me and Denton wanted to play hardcore. So, and me and Denton were the ones who lived near each other with the practice space, and I was writing a lot of the music in FSA, so we were like, hey, why don't we break up FSA because it's not really going anywhere. Although we did play a couple shows. We played one at Hallie and Whitney Dunn's garage in Reston, which was one of the – it was kind of a regular spot. There were shows at a lot of houses and a lot of garages when people's parents would go out of town. But Hallie and Whitney's had almost regular shows in their garage. And so we played one of those shows. I think we played with LDK in Hostile Environment. And I think one of Spooky Things. And we played another show at a skate ramp that was built in Herndon at a friend of ours named Scott Myers. We went and played that kind of, the first day it was ready. All these skaters came out, everyone was riding, we were playing out the side. And like a week later or something, allegedly some rival skaters burnt it down. It definitely got burnt down. I saw the aftermath, and was not odd in that era for rival skaters to be pretty aggressive towards each other. So I think that's probably what happened, although names will not be named.
So you mentioned some of the other players that were around and some of the other bands. Mm-hmm. Were there guys that were influential on you that you sort of, you know, watched playing around the scene? And
it was weird because when KID, Kids in Dispute, first started playing in the band with the circular saw blade for a cymbal, we didn't know about all the stuff going on at South Lakes because the world was so small back then. And we went to, me and Denton anyway, had gone to Langston Hughes. We were into The Clash and kind of passing around some other stuff. And remember Pat Kennedy from Hostile Environment, he was friends with me from back when we were kids. Our brothers were on the same soccer team. We were in, I think, the same gym class in, like, seventh grade. And he was like, what are you into? And I'm like, The Clash. And he's like, check this out. And he handed me Circle Jerks tape. Wonderful. And went home and I spun that. Oh, cool. These other guys down here are kind of into this stuff, too. But no one was really dressing punk. Until eighth grade, that's when we started kind of cutting out and going crazy with it. But I don't know if anyone else was really doing it, like dressing punk that early, except maybe Bo Butler. As far as like the musicians that we were with, there were a couple older guys, like I mentioned, that hung around Lake Ann. We cut out of that because we graduated. So we ended up going to Herndon, and no one had driver's licenses for like 2 years. Same on the south side. So we kind of didn't see these people for a while. There was enough kids in Herndon. It wasn't like the scene in South Lakes where like half the people were punk rockers. There was like 8 or 9 of us in Herndon. We were a tight little crew. We were kind of doing our own thing. We had no idea that these guys were doing this in South Lakes. So when we all got our driver's licenses and we kind of met back up, Hostile Environment was happening, LDK was happening. We were like, fuck, let's go to these shows. There's a house show at my friend Sam Dipka's house, who used to document a lot of stuff in the scene. We went down there. I think it was at his like stepdad's house or something. It was a day show, Hostile Environment and LDK. And Hostile Environment opened it up, and they played a song I'll always remember, which is just called Hostile Environment. Really, really catchy, almost kind of oi tune, which is great. And a couple others which I liked, one called Write to Me, and I can't really remember the rest of their set, but I thought they were awesome. And they were our friends, or people that we went to intermediate school with, you know, and Pat was our friend. And then LDK came on, and we were astounded. Tim was a beast on drums, and Andy, just an awesome front man. Really charismatic, and I'd say I've never seen anyone with that punk rock spirit just kind of coursing through him so obviously. And Andy Wells, kind of like a pure punk. And those songs were great. I remember hearing them play Stand Together, him doing the backup vocals at the end. And I was like, that guy can sing. And so they had the potential for two singers in the band. The drummer was great. These guys are already playing like little licks and leads, and they're writing real catchy, kind of tough hardcore songs. And I was like, yep, these are real bands. And we're doing our thing, FSA, or it might have been KID. I think it was FSA at the time. And I was like, we have some catching up to do because these guys are good. And so I think that's when we started. Everyone saw their peers, you know, our peers were doing this. And so we kind of looked to them, how should we be doing this? You know, especially I think LDK were like the scene kind of role models. And hostile environment, that was just like our boys. Like if we had all gone to the same high school together, we would have been in that crew. Maybe some of us would have been in hostile environment, or maybe some of them would have been in FSA. So it was a matter of role modeling yourself by people who are just like you, maybe a year or two ahead of you and playing their instruments, but not far ahead. But we saw, especially LDK was taking it seriously. These were not like joke punk songs. These were not bad songs or poorly written. They were well crafted. And something, maybe it's because of that, but the whole resting scene that sprang from LDK and hostile environment treated them so seriously musically. People learned how to play. They didn't just say, here's a dumb three-chord punk song, even though there's nothing wrong with that. And FSA had a couple of those, and enough even had one. But we treated it seriously. We all learned how to kind of script songs and how to play them. Good. It took a long time, but we ended up with a serious mindset about it. And one thing I remember is the early bands, we were like, the singer was the one that was like, I'm the one that you shouldn't treat seriously because I'm the one who doesn't have to play an instrument. I have the easy job. I have to carry a microphone. And that kind of stuck with me. It was the music. Like the singing is very important. Of course, that's what most people pay attention to, but singing is part of the decoration. Like you got to build the house first. And I think as a bassist, like I always had that mindset. You build the house, you make it a sturdy house, and then the singer can run around and do what he wants. But you have to make that house sturdy. And then you let the singer run with it and the guitar player play leads if he wants and all that. But I don't know if that really answered it. We're kind of role modeling ourselves. Like everyone else in the rest of the scene was kind of watching each other to see what to do.
So those guys were all making demos.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys put any effort into recording and trying to make your own demo too?
Not FSA and not KID. FSA was kind of, by the end of it, was being pulled in a lot of different directions. That would have been the time where we would have done a demo. But instead of, like, having a developed sound, we kind of de-developed in a way. So we just broke that up. And Denton and I formed Enough. And with Farshad, who was from Kids of Dispute, and our friend Mike McLeod, who had been singing for another local band called Corruption, who was the only other band, as far as I know, from the Lake Erin side. So he came and sang with us, and we did that. And that was 88 was when we formed, I think summer of 88. Pretty funny, actually, the way we started. Denton and I were talking about forming a band. Farshad and I were talking about forming a band. Farshad and I were like, let's jam. Let's find a drummer to jam with. This kid out of Herndon High School, his name was Dan. I don't remember his last name. He was a skater. He said, I'll play with you guys. Okay. So he had a house right next to the school. Farshad came in from Sterling, and I met I think he came and picked me up or something. We went over to this dude Dan's house. Farsha was like, I have a song written. He plays it for me. It ended up being the first Enough song called Fake Understanding, which is a really good song. okay, let's play. So drummer brings us downstairs. He's got new drums set up, but he has no cymbals. Once again, no cymbals. So I'm like, why is this always happening, right? So he has hi-hat cymbals, but there's no stand. So like, but we're in an unfinished basement. So we're like, let's set the kit up right under one of the beams, run a rope up and down, and hang the hi-hat next to the kit.
And dude, that's
we're
so
like,
funny.
Okay.
That's so funny because I talked to Jason Filippini on another episode. He was jamming with Todd Hoover, and they did the exact same thing.
That was it was.
I've never heard of anybody doing this before.
And now it's happened twice in Reston, of all places. Although technically this was in Herndon because it was right next to Herndon High, but it was a Reston band. It ended up being a Reston band, and so we're trying to play, and this dude is like chasing the hi hat around because it's hanging. And he's playing, trying to chase this thing around, and that just created Farshad and I. Well. We kind of thought it was really funny, and we started making fun of him. And he didn't really last as our drummer. But it was a good try, and when all is said and done, we were laughing at the experience, and we've hung out with that guy since, rapped with him. I think he's a friend of mine on Facebook. And he's a totally cool dude. But so... It was just an odd, like, rookie experience, you know, when you don't have gear. I mean, I've had crazy stuff happen on real stages, big stages, where the right equipment, like, something broke and someone used a floor tom as a kick drum, you know. And that happened once on a big stage playing with a big band. And I'm not going to tell that story completely because I don't want to mention who it was. It might make them look bad, but... I think it was really cool how the whole scene was MacGyvered with the floor tom as a kick drum when there were no other options. Show must go on, you know? But yeah, so anyway, we're like, maybe that's not the right drummer. But Denton had been playing drums while FSA was going on because the FSA kit was at his house. And he had kind of talked about playing drums. So FSA had broke up. Farshad and I talked to Denton, who we'd already been talking about forming like a hardcore band, and we decided to do it, and that became Enough. And Enough was the first band I was in that was, I think, reliably wrote good songs. We couldn't play it 100% right all the time, but the songs were good, and that's why I have Enough tattoo as like a yearbook kind of signature to myself about those times.
Well, so the show is called Jams for Man, and a lot of those other bands were getting serious and playing Jam for Man. I know that you guys played at least one of the Jam for Man concerts.
Yeah, Enough played one of them. We played. It's called the Festival of Fiends. It was on Halloween 89, and it was a big show. There was a couple hundred kids there at the Reston Community Center. Brian Stewart kind of set up that whole series, and I got to give him props for that. That was a really good thing. A way to get us out of the garages and basements when the cops kept coming. And a way to get more kids into the rooms in a way we could wire the hell out of a place and hopefully fit a couple hundred people into a room. And then it happened. But this show, it was pretty big. DOS, I think, opened, which was Fan Vistis on vocals. I think maybe Terry Marquez on bass or something, and maybe Jason Browning on drums. I'm imagining this, but Carter Blitch might have played drums in that. I don't really remember. He's in JFA now. I know he played in another band, Knothead, back then. But those us Transilians played too. And I remember it was Halloween, so I think everyone kind of wanted to play their set and get out and go do Halloween stuff. But there was a lot of kids at the show.
Well, you gotta have spooky on. You gotta have something spooky on Halloween.
Well, it was spooky. Stan wore a pumpkin on his head the whole show, and Spooky was playing, and so that's spooky. And then here's another spooky thing: Transilient, who's easily the most talented group of guys in the wrestling scene, so much so that when we did BSR a couple of years ago, we started it out as a tribute to old wrestling bands to just play one show at Greg Corbett's house for his 40th birthday in wrestling. We did, I think, we did a lot of the bands, but we did not mess with Transilience because that would have just taken forever, and we probably wouldn't have been able to pull it off anyway. So that was our tribute to them, is to not play them. Because we couldn't. And they were like 17 and 18 years old at that time, and we're like 40. We still can't do it. So anyway, that's Transilience. Enough is playing with Transilience. We're like, these guys are the best. They're headlining. And Spooky wants to go, I think. So he's like, let's draw straws or flip a coin or something to see who headlines. So we do that, and end up Enough headlined. We were like, this is absurd. But a lot of the kids that came to the show didn't know about that, so they looked at us as we were supposed to be a headliner, and they treated us like a headliner. Like, the floor was going crazy with tons of moshing kids. It was probably the biggest pit I've had to one of my bands to this day, a couple hundred kids. And it was a really cool experience. And it was a big, giant circle pit, too, which I'm always stoked about. Anyway, so that's kind of all I remember about that night, is we probably shouldn't have headlined, but we did. Transilience blew us away and played before us, but the kids didn't seem to notice, and they all went off, and so that was awesome. And that was, yeah, that was the, I think that's the only time any of my bands ever played Jam for Man show. It was presented as Jam for Man's Productions, I think. Jam for Man Productions.
So you guys did record with Enough.
We did,
You got some songs down.
Yeah, like the other, like Kids in Dispute, there was a practice tape. FSA, there was a practice tape, which I still have. I'm going to send you a couple tracks off that. Enough, we had a practice tape, which is funny. The first day we recorded this tape, that night Spooky came and hung out at Denton's house. We played him the practice tape. He's like, oh, that's cool. Is there anything on the other side of the tape? I said, no. He's like, okay, flip it over. And he put a tape in the other deck. And he recorded onto the back of our practice tape on Enough, or I mean a Transilience really early demo. And I don't even know if he knows about it, if he remembers it even exists. So on the back of the Enough practice tape, there's an early Transilience recording of two songs. So in early 89, we went to Spooky's house to record in his basement, and we were so green. Like, my knobs were all messed up on. I didn't even know how to set bass tones. And Spooky's like, do you like this bass tone? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. And so he didn't mess with it. We all played like we were so kind of in shock at actually recording that we just kind of played through our songs, and unless it was a massive error, like we had to stop, we just played through, and that's what we recorded. So the demo has lots of mistakes on it, and it's got the tiniest, worst bass tone ever, and that's totally not Spooky's fault. That's my fault. But I didn't know better at the time. So a couple weeks later, Spooky has it mixed and mastered, and we get it. And we had acquired, through some sort of semi-nefarious means, a lot of really cheap cassettes, or So I Hear, that's we acquired them through nefarious means. And so we dubbed them all in these cassettes that we got for free. And we had paid Spooky like $50, I think. So we put out our demo and we're selling it for $2 because we got the tapes for free. And I remember some of the other, one of the other singer on one of the other Repton bands was pissed. He was like, "You're undercutting us. Blah." He was all angry and yelled at us. We're like, dude, we would love to sell it for $5, but we don't feel right selling it for $5 because these are stolen. These were stolen, okay? Now there are enough demos. Get off our back, man. We're putting some risk into this, man. And so we recorded that. And then I probably shouldn't have, but I'm always real curious about moving around and playing different instruments. I'd already been playing some guitar and writing some enough songs on guitar. Like, hey, I wanted to be the other guitar player. We went to get a new bassist. We tried some people out. John Schaefer tried out. He actually ended up as the bassist in two of my later bands. And Kevin Blankspore tried out, and Terry Marquez tried out. We heard Terry just wanted to come try to get my amp, because my amp was like a good amp for a high school kid or something. So, Terry, we found you out, and that's why you didn't get the gig, but he was the best bass player to come by. Kevin Blackmore was in Psychotic Symptoms on guitar. They broke up. He wanted to switch to bass. So we tried him out, and he was kind of playing bass in the direction that some of us really liked, which is like really speed, lots of runs. We've been listening to a lot of RKL, which is like really technical, hardcore. And he kind of played like that. We were like, "You're the guy." And so he ended up on bass. I was on second guitar. And then that's the lineup that played that Halloween show. But eventually they kind of started going in a direction that I was kind of unhappy with. I think with the speed bass, it kind of sped up the band. And I was like, "Yeah, we're playing so fast, we can't play the riffs right." And they just kept going. And I was like, "Okay, I think it's maybe time for me to bow out, because you guys are taking it to a different place." And all respect, you know. They kept playing. I quit. They recorded another demo with Joe Banks. From the Veil at Denton's house. And that's a really good recording, and you can hear how fast the band had become. It's like a totally different thing from this like kind of band that when we were playing stuff right was really in the pocket, and then to this band that was really into like speed, it almost became a thrash band, which is cool, but it wasn't really my thing. But a couple of the songs that I wrote ended up on that. And, of course, I supported it. I've always looked at bands as families. And what those dudes do after you leave a band, it still carries your name with it, because you used to be in the band. So I think everyone should always support their bands, their ex-bands, their ex-bandmates, in whatever endeavors, because bands are like families, and you support your family, and also it helps you out too. The better those guys do, the better you do just by being associated with them. My friend Gwomper had problems at school, and he wanted to get out of his situation too. So Avail had moved out of Richmond, and we just kind of followed them down, and I practice with a band that I was trying to get started down there, like just two or three times, but that didn't really pan out. I think Denton called me up, and he's like, "Hey, we want to play a last show. Farshot can't play. You want to come up and play guitar?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." So we worked out a couple practice dates and went up and practiced with them a couple times, and then played at friend's house in Great Falls, like in the backyard, with with his band, which was like a genre fusion, kind of punky, funky, type thing. That stuff had started kind of kicking off around that point. So, the last show was, I think, 91 or 92, something like that, or early 92 or late 91. And that was that for Enough.
It was Enough.
That was it. It was enough. Everyone had had enough. Moved on. Then I took a couple years off of school. That's when I got my English degree. Got a new band together. I've been out of the punk scene for like 10 years because it got too crew-oriented and violent, and all these people were claiming to be posse, but like just spending all their time dissing each other and beating each other up, and I was like, I'm done. But about 10 years after that, like around 2002, a friend of mine took me to a show out at WJFK parking garage in Fairfax, where the WJFK radio station was. And there was a guy in the punk scene, they put Suspects on a radio show there called Capital Radio, and he set up some shows in the parking garage. The show was Suspects, Mama Society, and the Goons. And I went to that show, and it felt like it wasn't a bunch of crews like talking crap about each other across the pit and ready to beat each other up. It felt like an old 80s punk show, and I was like, okay, I can do this again. So I got a band together. It's kind of like experimental hardcore called Porch Mob. And we hadn't had, none of us had had like a real album out. We'd had demos out. So we just kind of forced out an album just to get one out. And it's kind of hit or miss. But right after we recorded, we got a really good lineup together, started playing some better shows. CBGBs, played FDR Skate Park in Philly, played a couple other out-of-town shows, Richmond, out in somewhere in West Virginia. And then that band kind of fell apart, constant lineup changes. And then I took more time off to do school. I went back to school to get a biochem degree. So I did that. And then got back in with a band called Nervous Impulse with Surge from the Goons and John Schaefer, who was in Porch Mob with me, and he had tried out for Enough back in the 80s. Nick Deems, who had been with the Twats, and another guy from the quads named Ian was playing bass at first, and then he bowed out shortly after. And then that's when John Schaefer came in, and we recorded a demo down in Richmond, Minimum Wave Studios. And then we were kind of playing tunes and popping the demo for like a buck at the show or something, and we made some shirts ourselves. And then we just kept, we wanted to keep going, and Schaefer was kind of ready to bow out. He had something that he had to go do, or so I don't really remember exactly why he left, but rather than find a new bassist, I just switched to bass, because I can play bass too. It's a lot easier if you already have a bassist in the band, and to bring someone else in. So the lineup that recorded this album, which I'm very proud of, was me, John, me and Nick Dean, and John Bergner on drums, and Serge on vocals. We went into studio in Olney, Maryland with Drew Mazurek and recorded 14 songs in a day. We rehearsed so hard, we got all these tracks done. A couple of them didn't end up with vocals on them, but we had enough for a record, and we put that out, self-release. For the insert for it. We've taken a little break. We lost our drummer. So we got Schaefer back in. I switched back to guitar, and we found a new drummer, Dave Bird from Striking Distance, and we went and played a bunch of shows. And by the time we sold out my pressing, and Dave Bird knew some people at Big Nine, and they wanted to repress the record. So, of course, they have a really good distro. So Bridge Nine repressed and released our record. And then we got to writing another round of tunes, and it just kind of didn't feel the same. Like, it was easy, and the songwriting team was different. And I think that's very important, the chemistry of the songwriters. And it just didn't feel right to me. And I wanted to do more, go out of town more than they wanted to do. They wanted to stay local. So I just left the band. And they were trying out. And a couple of guitar players had tried out this dude. Mark from Dinkins was at my house because I wanted to help them keep going. And then that didn't pan out for some reason. And I heard Serge kept trying to keep it together, but wasn't able to end up with a solid lineup. So he did another band instead. And then that album is I'm most proud of, I think, out of all the recordings that I've done. It came out great. And I finally had a really good...
Okay. I really like that album.
Yeah, and I was really stoked because I got to play bass at my highest level of copying Daryl Jennifer of the Bad Ranks. And that's something I always wanted to do. And the band doesn't sound like Bad Brains because Nick plays in a more, like, kind of rock metal style. The drummer sounds different. Surge didn't sound anything like HR. So I got to do, like, a Daryl Jennifer impersonation without it seeming too obvious. And now I'm spilling the beans on myself. And anyway, that band was great. And while that band was happening, we started doing BSR. Brian talked to me. Brian Security said, hey, you want to do a couple old wrestling songs at Greg Corbett's 40th birthday party? I said, absolutely. That sounds like fun. So we did that. There's a video of that somewhere online. Somehow people keep giving us shows. And we were like, okay, we'll take the shows. And eventually when we started playing a lot of shows, it was, I think me and Jerry especially were like, we're going to be playing a bunch of shows, let's write some music. So we're not like a cover band of our own bands, which was fun, but that was fun for like, couple shows, and after a while it's like, this is weird, let's be a real band. So we wrote a 7-inch worth of material, played a bunch of shows, recorded this. We went back up to, I had such a nervous impulse experience up at Drew Masrick's studio was so good that we went back up there for BSR, and he did an awesome job on that as well. 6 songs, which is, by the way, still available on vinyl. If you want some, come talk to me. Time off because I had a kid named Austin, who's almost 4, who's amazing.
He's smarter than us,
which is he's smarter than us already, which is problematic. Last night he was his mom was trying to get him to his room to put him to sleep. He ran into his room, locked the door, like turned the lock, ran out of the room and closed the door, so the door's locked on the inside, so he couldn't. His mom could not open the door to get into the room because he wanted to sleep in mommy and daddy's bed. That is pretty slick, if you ask me.
Really?
And
slick.
I'm also very scared.
You're in
that's
trouble.
How smart he is already? Yeah. And the karma for how crazy me and my brother were during the latchkey era with, like, no supervision ever, you know, I mean, the karma is going to come back and get me. So I should probably get really right wing or something so he rebels as like a punker, you know, because he's going to rebel. Anyway, so after all that, I always need to play. I just take big great breaks because life isn't just music. So I went to that, took breaks from school a couple times, and just when the scene kind of sucked, I didn't play that much. And but I got this new thing together just recently called Rise Defy. We played our first show a year ago out of Fredericksburg. We got a demo out, played a bunch of shows. We just came from Richmond and Virginia Beach show a couple weekends ago, which both went fantastically. Played with some really good bands, Creep Crusades, Wolves of the Dry Ravine, a band called Ladrones from Puerto Rico. We played with them in Virginia Beach. They were superb. And we're looking forward to doing a lot more. We're having a good time. It's me and Nick Means from Nervous Impulse and the Twats, and Paul Maniscalco, who was the drummer in the project that was in the late 90s, All Fall Down, which I talked about earlier. And so right now it's a three-piece. However, if somebody out there wants to add a little flavor on guitar with some nice, cool, tasteful licks, feel free to give me a ring, because we're thinking about adding on another guitar player.
I watched some of the videos on Fan's YouTube channel.
Cool. The one that he just put up?
Yeah. He posted some stuff from you guys, and it was real cool.
Cool. I'm glad you liked it. How loud is this ice that I'm chewing on the podcast?
It's not too bad.
I think that's all you hear. Find that frequency and mix it up.
So what's the plan for Rise Defy? Is there a mission for you guys? Is there something, someplace that you'd like to take the band that you haven't been before? Something that you still want to accomplish?
I mean, yeah, but mainly it's all of, like, my whole thing has always been, I need a kind of way I can write music and get it out there. So my main concern is like writing good songs and like trying to be really good about self-editing and not letting like ego end up in the songs, because you can always hear that. So it's kind of a different project than a lot of ones that I've done, in that it's punk, it's not hardcore. I've been to Clash and Generation X and bands like that before I was in hardcore, and I've always kind of wanted to do a band more along those lines. So the stuff I've been writing has kind of been leading in that direction. And it's been real fun, and so far it seems like people like it a lot, so we're stoked to keep doing this. And we write slow because we're real careful about what we're writing, but we're writing new stuff as we speak. We just recorded a couple of riffs the other day that we just came up with on practice, and they sound real good. I think our next thing is to write a couple more songs, go in the studio, record them, and maybe pair that up with a recording that we did last fall at Don Zantara's Inner Ear Studios, which is five songs, which we're thinking about being an EP, but if we get some new songs attached to it, maybe we'll do it for one.
You're the only one I talk to who's still recorded at Inner Ear. Everybody else was recording back at Inner Ear, you know, back in the 90s. What's it like recording over there now?
Oh, man. I mean, I didn't record there in the 90s. The first time I was over there was 2004, I think, with a band called VPR, which I somehow forgot to mention, but I was in VPR in 2004, I think. We did a couple tours and went to Inner Ear. The band was a hardcore band. A lot of fun to play with those guys. But that was the first time I recorded with Don. And Don is so chill and so knowledgeable. And his studio is, like, real relaxing. He's been in that room for a long time, and he's got it all set up for – there's a lot of downtime at studios. He's got, like, little, like – brain teasers and puzzles and stuff lying around and keep yourself occupied. And, he's just a really cool guy who knows a lot, and he adds a little flavor to the recording in ways that we wouldn't have thought to do. So he's really good to work with still. and plus all that history of interviewer, you can kind of feel it soaking in when you're working with them there.
It's good to hear. It's good to know that people from the area are still recording over there, and the Don is still, you know, putting out great stuff with people.
Yeah, he really is. We went in there and recorded a song for a project which was meant to re-envision some of the Clash Mark II material when after Mick Jones and Top or Head were not in the Clash anymore. Joe Strummer and Paul Simonon kept going, and they did an album called Cut the Crap, which their manager, Bernie Rhodes, destroyed by releasing an album that was basically sounds like an experimental mix. The songs are good, though, and if you look at live clips on YouTube of the shows from that era, they were killer. A guy named Bill Daly, who runs Crooked Beat Records in Alexandria, Virginia, he was a huge Clash fan. He had an idea, let some fans do these songs, record them right, and make a record out of it. So he did a volume one of that, and that did really well, so he did a volume two. And part of that was a double album. And the second album of that was songs that would have been Clash songs had the band stayed together. And Joe Strummer and Mick Jones started writing again after they made up for the second Big Audio Dynamite record. There's a song called V13, which Rise to Five covered for Bill Daly's project called Recutting the Crap 2. And we did a really good job with it, I think. I like how the job that we did with it.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
So that was at Don's, and so while we were there, we just recorded another couple songs. Don was also doing songs for that project. And so that, we have finished our little EP there, because we're not sure exactly how we're going to handle a release just yet, but that's almost done. And maybe I'll send you a little sneak peek of that as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear that. Not to mention, like, this Clash record that I'm first hearing about for, you know, the first time, these covers.
Yeah, check it out. I think he's got this
sounds like a cool
online
idea.
Yeah, I think he's got it up on Bandcamp. So it's called Recutting the Crap, Volumes 1 and 2. And they're both really good records. It was a really good thing to do because that Cut the Crap record made people think that the Clash just ended in utter crap disaster, but their shows were good at that time. It was the mix that Bernie Rhodes, the manager, decided to make the final mix that is terrible.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, it sounds like getting a chance to record that stuff really takes you back to your roots as a kid, you know, first getting into punk and discovering this kind of music and, you know, inspiring you to play. So
there's a quote. I'm a big Bob Marley fan. There's a quote from one of his songs that's, don't you forget your youth and who you are and where you stand in the struggle. And I try to kind of keep that with me, you know, to try to maintain integrity, which, you know, I kind of look at people, we're like trees that are growing. We're just constantly growing from a root, and you can't go too far from that. So if you deny your youth, you're denying your roots, and you're not going to be able to grow. So I try to keep my youth with me and grow out of it rather than look at it as a phase. Because I think the things that we were doing back then, they were in good fun, and they were also real serious, and we were onto something which I think was real positive, which was a more free world rather than this real constricted, strict world that the 80s social structure was. You still see that stuff in the dimensions of social life nowadays, although it's kind of like the punks won the war. A friend of mine got hit by a car in the 80s for having a mohawk. He got hit by a car because he had a mohawk. Guys ran their car at him. And I don't think that happens too much these days. Maybe out in Stick. But this was in Reston, which is a progressive little town. And nowadays, kids are dyeing their hair at, you know, age 11 and looking like weirdos, and their parents are supportive of it and stuff. It's like we took a couple beatings, but we won the war, you know? It seems like socially the world is a little bit freer place, and maybe punk has something to do with that. I don't know. But
well,
because of that, I suspect it did. That's why I keep it with me, because it's important.
I mean, I was going to ask you what you got from being raised in Reston and from participating in this Reston hardcore scene, but it sounds like, you know, we can already hear what you got from it.
Yeah, and I got opportunities to play with some really good musicians. Like I said, Jason Browning. I get to list everyone I played with, and they're all sick. I got to play with some of my heroes. I was able to jump on stage with Angelo Moore from Fishbone a couple times. Played with HR. I think all that came out of Reston. I mean, we didn't really know it, but I think we suspected there was just a feeling that this was a very special time back in the late 80s in Reston, and this hardcore thing was a little supernova, you know, and it exploded out, and then it just went away, and we all grew out of it, you know? Tim Berry is doing awesome. Avail did great. Spooky is still killing it. Mike Munoz and Craig Harmison are laying low, but they're still putting out awesome music. Jerry is still doing it. Carter Blitz is out playing in JFA. I've been in JFA for 15 years, I think. 13, 15 years. Brian Stewart's still running around doing shows with Ruined by Design. I'm doing it. I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple names. Chris Pools from FSA, he's got a band in Richmond. I don't think they're too active, but they're doing it. And Sam Gunderson, who's the first guy I ever saw play in a basement with Crunchy Water from Reston. They played a friend of mine's birthday party when she was in like ninth grade or eighth grade. I think she was in seventh grade. We were in eighth grade. Sam came down with Lefty Fur and Dick Cater, the brother of Aaron Cater, who's a big comedian now, and played this sick set in my friend's basement. And they could play already, like, at a high level. They were in, like, eighth grade. And we looked at each other and said, we better get the playing soon because I think this is what we're going to want to do. And so, I mean, we all kind of fed each other. And like you were saying, we were kind of watching what each other were doing. And we grew out of it. We all grew as musicians in that little incubator town. And the fact that there's so many of us still doing it, and so a couple of us have reached pretty decent level, I mean, it's inspiring. And I think, as Brian used to say at the BSR shows to the kids, you know, we're proof that you don't have to stop. You can keep doing this until you're 70, you know, or we're going to probably try. I think I'm a lifer. Brian's a lifer. I think Tim's a lifer. Spooky, Jerry. And it all started in wrestling, you know. It was a cool, very, I think a unique upbringing. I mean, tons of other suburbs had bands and shows that I think what Reston had was something about the way that the place defined itself as a unique place, a progressive place, a place that was more an idea than a regular suburb. That kind of got into everyone, and we became like, it was like a town full of really aggressive progressives. And we were really aggressive about pursuing music, too. And I think that'll always stick with me. Lake Ann is always going to be my home. And that's why the online handle is Lake Ann Dave. That's me.